The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi, this is Danny Roth, and this is Everyday Horror. It's a podcast where we watch at least one horror movie for every day in the month of October, and then we talk about them. I'm joined today by the host and creator of the ongoing YouTube series Folding Ideas, Dan Olson.
Hello, hello.
How you doing, man?
I'm on the mend, still a little froggy.
You're still in the, you have the bronc?
I got the bronc.
Well, that's all right. That means you've got the you have sexy bronc voice.
Yeah,
that's how that yeah. works. What movie did you select?
So I picked Coraline.
Why did you pick Coraline?
So I picked Coraline because I think children's horror is an underappreciated subgenre of not just horror but movies as a whole. Part of this comes from like my growing up in, you know, growing up in the 80s, there was a lot of children's horror in the 80s, and even a lot of just like mainstream children's films had horror elements to them. But then through the 90s, that really went away, and we wound up kind of culturally adopting this sort of standpoint of like, it's like, oh, inappropriate for children.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. I had a thesis after I sat down and watched Coraline for the first time in almost 10 years, because it came out in 2009, and I don't think I've seen it in its completion since I saw it in theaters. And that is that by the metrics of children's horror in my mind, I think that Coraline is maybe the best example of what children's horror can and probably should be.
It's kind of a exemplar in that regard. And then actually, I mean, just to kind of enumerate the point, like, so I was watching I'm doing a thing about American Tail right now, and so I rewatched American Tail last night, and that got me thinking, like, Don Bluth is actually a good sort of comparison point for this. Is that you think about all of his movies in the 80s, and, you know, Secret of Nim, American Tail, even, you know, Land Before Time,
All Dogs Go to Heaven.
Like, there are, whether it be a tone throughout the film or so Secret of Nim is a horror movie, Land Before Time, like, and those other three absolutely have sequences that are definitely horror film. The one that everybody thinks of course, being All Dogs Go to Heaven, the scene where Charlie goes to hell, his nightmare. The interesting thing to me, as someone who was a child and who did consume those movies, I loved Don Bluth movies as a kid. Basically, every single one that came out when I was like old enough to go to theaters, I saw in theaters, and we had like the VHS tape of All Dogs Go to Heaven, and I watched it over and over and over again. And same with An American Tale. And there's this sort of weird thing where we as adults impose our values onto kids. We look at something and we go, oh, that's too scary for kids, because it scares us in some way as adults, but in a uniquely adult way. You know, there's a lot of things that we'll look at imagery of, you know, kind of like, often it'll be something that's very existential, kind of scary, and we'll look at that and go, it's like, oh, well, kids can't watch. It's like, that's inappropriate for children. That's way too dark. And it's like, a seven-year-old isn't going to get it. A seven-year-old doesn't understand like the permanence of death, or they don't fear the permanence of death in the same way that a like 40-year-old does.
What I find to be really interesting about that is the result of adults, or I guess parents, saying, oh, this child shouldn't watch this because it's scary, sort of creates a situation wherein, for a child, the very act of watching something that could be considered horror in any way becomes in and of itself an act of rebellion.
Yeah, it's transgressive.
Right. So I think that's a big part of why kids love horror, because I would say, generally speaking, a lot of kids really love it. They like being scared. Yeah. And I do think that that not only is it that they like being scared and then feeling safe when it's all over, which is how most horror movies that we show to kids tend to work. But yes, also this act of rebellion, also this transgressiveness, because the parents are saying, like, now, are you sure that you can handle this? Or, you know, like, this might be too scary for you. Immediately, it's that reverse psychology of, I have to. I must have it in order to go against what it is that my parents want me to do.
The key thing in there, like, kids really do love being scared. Like, I mean, they're mini adults, you know, that really children's genres are, or I don't know, maybe philosophically ought to be handled with the mature, like, give kids the benefit of the doubt. Treat them with maturity. You know, adults, you need to know the limits of what kids can handle and what is appropriate for them. But they can handle a lot more than you would assume. And it's like, what if my kid gets a nightmare? It's like, well, then your kid gets a nightmare. You know, what if you get a nightmare? Like, you know, adults aren't immune to scary dreams. And it's kind of weird that, like, we culturally have decided that, like, kids can't handle scary experiences. Kids can't handle scary media. They can't handle that whole, you know, genre of emotion purely because parents don't want to have to deal with the inconvenience of maybe they're going to get woken up at, you know, 3 a.m. by a kid who's had a scary dream.
Yeah, and yet there is all of this stuff, or at least there was, geared towards that. Do you remember your first sort of blush with horror that was at least ostensibly meant to be for kids? Do you remember the first one for you?
Oh, the first, I think chronologically it probably would have been Land Before Time or Brave Little Toaster. I would need to go actually, like, pull out a timeline and, like, plot all of those movies, because, you know, they're far enough into my childhood that it's all just a giant soup of memories.
Sure. I was trying to think about it, and I came up with a memory that I think predates all the others. And what's interesting about it is that it's not a movie. It's an audiobook. So when I was a kid, we went to these places called libraries.
Yeah.
And my mother would go to research stuff because she would go to junk sales and occasionally, you know, want to feel researched what might be worth money. So she would go to the library and take out all these books and stay and read there for a while. And she would leave me in this section of the Bergenfield Library that had all these records that you could take over and listen to. And I found a record audiobook of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Oh, yeah. Classic.
And I was in a brightly lit library, but it was absolutely terrifying. I think, like, the very first story in that book is the one about the toe. Like, the kid finds the toe in the ground and rips it out and brings it back to the parents. The parents say, we'll cook it up and slice it up into three pieces and eat it. And then the zombie or whatever it was that was attached to the toe comes looking for its toe. And yeah. And then, as far as we can tell, eats or kills or otherwise destroys the child, and it destroyed me, and I loved it. I was in a brightly lit library. I thought I was gonna die. I thought that zombie was right behind me for sure. And that's the cool thing about horror, because it's not like that's an example of something wherein that book series would pull from sort of classic fables and
campfire stories.
Right, and, yeah. Exactly. And when we talk a little bit more about Coraline, It's interesting the way that creates its own sort of campfire stories within it.
Yeah.
To sort of weave its narrative. But what I think is interesting is that there was a, I think you're right, that there was a long period of time wherein there wasn't stuff that was specifically made for kids that was still scary, you know? And part of that, I wonder if it's not, I wonder if the transition doesn't start to happen a little bit with the PG-13 rating, because that happened to right around Poltergeist.
Yeah, so a couple of the things that I'd point to would probably be the PG-13 rating and Goosebumps.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that Goosebumps really redefined the idiophorm of what children's horror looks like, which is not horror. It's at best horror comedy, or really it's comedy with kind of a gross bent to it.
Yeah, it's even kind of like it's interesting to watch the evolution, right, to Goosebumps, because before Goosebumps there was Fear Street.
Fear Street was tame, but it was still like, you know, it was still fundamentally like 80s slasher movie kind of books. I mean, and the target market for that was like 16-year-olds.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, I do think that's interesting. But then, yeah, for a really long time, there's not a lot of anything. And then the 2000s happened. And I think that it's interesting because you picked Coraline, but Coraline also kind of comes along with the company that is responsible for adapting it.
Mm-hmm.
That then made, I think, a series of other ones. Didn't they also make Paranorman and Monster House?
Yeah, so they went on to do Paranorman, Box Trolls, and then Kubo and the Two Strings.
And they all kind of feel in a way like the inheritor of what 80s and very early 90s kids horror was.
Yeah. I guess I should also mention they were not the production house, but did the animation on Corpse Bride as well.
Yes, which is kind of a different. I don't want to talk about Corpse Bride. That's it. I have nothing to say about that. That's going to be terribly positive. So
yeah, I mean, so Paranorman, I've actually never seen.
Pretty good.
I've heard good things about it though. Does it actually have horror elements? See, because in my mind, it's basically Hotel Transylvania, where it's like it's using horror characters.
I think it definitely has more horror than a Hotel Transylvania does, as does Monster House for sure.
Okay. Because
Monster House is literally it's a story wherein there's a monster house that eats people.
Monster House, isn't that the psychopaths that made Beowulf?
I think it might be. I would have to double check it.
Like that's the Mars Needs Moms crew.
Yeah, but good. I went back. I had watched, I made a video like a year and a half ago that was all about this, about horror movies that I think you can show to kids. And I included Monster House because I'd never seen it before, but everyone kept telling me, you should watch it. You should watch it. And
I think Monster House is the one Image Movers movie that Zemeckis was not overly involved on, which is why it's the one Image Movers movie that's good.
Shots fired. So, all right. So there's some interesting stuff about Coraline. So I guess from the outset, obviously, if people don't know, it is based on a novella by Neil Gaiman.
Yes.
He had pretty much just made it when the director of Nightmare Before Christmas came and said, hey, my name is Henry Selick, and I would like to make this into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then it took them a little while to get it done. They added some stuff because I think that the idea was that it would only be like 45 minutes long if it was done as the book intended. So they added some characters and it took them a really long time because they had to, you know, it's stop motion animation in the truest sense. And it took them a really long time to make. And then a thing that I think most people forget is that it came out in 2009, which is a really weird year for movies in general. But It came out in February, which is a death month for horror movies. Especially, that's like January and February are notoriously these months where...
It's the dumping ground, especially in 2009. Like, I mean, I think at this point there's been such a saturation, especially with the, like, the franchise sequels that we've kind of, I don't know, acclimated to it. But 2009, February was a garbage heap.
Yeah. And especially the thing about January, I mean, there's literally a term called January horror movies, but it really sort of encapsulates both those months wherein, we made this movie and it's trash. So we'll just dump it in these 2 months because we know it's not going to make any money, so it's astonishing to think that this movie that was so much effort and has now gone on to be a classic, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we both might argue is, again, like sort of exemplar of what a children's horror film can be and what it probably should be. And yet, like, it made pretty... I mean, for February, it did well.
Yeah, it did respectably. It did respectably. So it did 124 million against a budget of 60.
Yeah. Now, I think the goal was to make a little bit more than that, but their hope was to make in that ballpark. And one has to assume that, and there is, to tease it, Coraline, or our protagonist, has a doll that looks just like her. And having worked in a comic book store / nerdatorium, I can tell you that that particular thing, that particular item, is something that people want to own. So I think that whoever had the rights for that, or however things shook out, there was a lot of money that got made in memorabilia. Not quite as much as Nightmare Before Christmas, but Nightmare Before Christmas, I think, might be in like the top five most well merchandised films ever made, because it just never... that is like an endless ream of things that people... I don't know why.
Well, and the fascinating thing there is that the merchandising for Nightmare Before Christmas didn't kick in until like 5 years after the movie came out, when all of the kids who watched it were suddenly teenagers. And and Hot Topic really took off, and Hot Topic was big on like, oh well, we're just going to like sub-license merchandising rights, so that is, and Disney was kind of in a weird place at the time. So I think it was just a confluence of events that just made it really easy for Hot Topic to be like, yo, give us the rights to this and we will crank out merch for you, and you don't need to do anything but collect 20%. And the rest is history. The rest is Skeleton Boyfriend.
Yeah, Hot Topic does have that particular... it's like the algorithm, right? You go in and you buy one of them, and then they say, oh, you like that, and then you buy everything else. And I think so. It's like, yeah, between like Slave Laborers, Johnny the Homicidal Maniac, and Nightmare Before Christmas, you just reach a point where anything that is even a little bit like those two things is going to sell. And Coraline, I think, slotted in enough that... I'm sure by this point they've seen return. We'll call Coraline at the very least, after the fact, a success.
Yeah, I mean, even just like on box office, because they didn't have a very aggressive marketing campaign.
No, so I don't think they spent more than 20 or 30 million at most.
Yeah, so I think that 124 million box office represents a comfortable profit. Not quite the maybe massive blockbuster that everybody dreams of, but if they were doing sort of the balancing act, and I think this is probably what they were doing, of the balancing act of like, okay, well, if we release in February, it's not a great month, but we will easily be the best thing that comes out that week. And we will probably be the only thing that families can go to that isn't left over from Christmas. And so I think that was probably their calculus. And so they wound up, not making absolute gangbusters, but still making a very healthy profit. So I would suspect the producers are probably pretty happy with its theatrical performance. And then they're probably extremely happy with the downstream licensing performance.
Yeah. And then we can talk about the legacy. So here's my thesis on children's horror is that the key to it is that it has it succeeds in its balancing act of scary and wonder.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Like if you're gonna select two things that are the most important that have to appear in something that is scary, that is horror, but is designed specifically for children, is that it should scare them. Like I think it's a waste if something isn't scary. Then you know, then what's the point? But it also has to be wondrous, and I think that is kind of where we can begin looking at the film specifically. I think what I find fascinating about it is that it has such, I mean, the visual narrative is incredible. Right from the outset, I think something that's brilliant is the opening credits are not Coraline. They don't introduce Coraline. They introduce the villain, the Beldam.
Yeah.
But they do it in a very specific way, which is that you see the Beldam's hands.
Mm-hmm.
Not the rest of her, just her hands.
Just her hands.
And then the same happens when we finally get to Coraline and she is moving into this new house where she's staying. You, again, the same thing. You see her mother's hands before you see anything else,
mm-hmm.
which is brilliant.
Yeah, there's just a lot of really, really solid filmmaking in the movie, a lot of really good, you know, framing and direction, and it's clear that they spent a lot of time. I mean, well, it's stop motion, so of course they spent a lot of time, but that there was a lot of consideration put into like every little step of it, and I think the way that it escalates is really kind of brilliant. And just on the scary but wondrous side, I think one of the horror elements in this movie that works so well for kids is that this kind of goes back to the whole thing. It's like, well, we as adults are going to think that something's inappropriate. And but what I think resonates with kids in it is the horror of not being paid attention to.
Absolutely.
And that's really the thing that it's like, if there's a thing in there that's going to like, just really like needle into a kid, you know, it's not going to be the giant spider at the end. It's going to be it's existentialism for kids is this like, oh, what if everybody just stops paying attention to me?
Right, she's moved, she's no longer, she has no safety net whatsoever, and she's completely isolated, and when we meet her parents, both of them are not directly relating to her, they are looking at their computers, and she is a nuisance.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I do love about the dynamic that they have there is that the parents are kind of absentee but not negligent.
Right. That's a really interesting line that they walk.
Looking at it as an adult, it's like, okay, these are two people who are just, they are at a transitional point in the, like the family as a whole is at a transitional point. They're both thinking to themselves like, okay, I just need to get through this one thing and then we've got our feet on the ground and then it's back to normal. And that sort of obsession with the transition has got them believing that Coraline is more resilient than she is.
Yeah, and they do. There are moments of pretty, I don't want to say extreme unkindness, but there are some sharp words. I think one of the lines that always stuck out for me in the movie is they're sitting down to eat dinner and Coraline is not happy with what's being cooked. And her mother says, your father cooks, I clean, and you stay out of the way. Which I think sets up the entire dynamic for where they are right now. Now, she means you stay out of the way right now while we get things figured out. But the thing that the parents, because they're adults, think is understood, that silent end of the sentence, because it's unspoken, Coraline has no reason to assume that.
Because they've been alive for 30 to 40 years and know that like, oh, well, a week really isn't that long. they're not thinking about it through the mind of, how old is Coraline in the movie? She's like, not 10?
Maybe. I mean, she's in that tween range.
She's in that, so, you know, they're not thinking through the eyes of a tween where, like, summer is still eternity and a year is forever. And, you know, a month of, you know, not being paid attention to is, yeah, like they're not, they don't appreciate her time scale and her understanding of time. So yeah, they think it's like, you just, it's like, look, just give us some breathing room while we finish the move. And she's like, no, this is, you're saying that this is the nature of our relationship, is that I stay out of the way. That's my relationship to you.
And the other thing about being at that age is that you're sort of at the grips of rebellion, but also craving normalcy.
Yeah.
And sort of wanting to adhere to certain rules. And I think one of the things that's interesting about the setup for this
is kind of like the foundations of horror go great with being a tween.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, she's there. She's upset because her dad is cooking weird food. And the neighbors that they live with are also very strange. So she's got no rule to latch on to. Even these people who are supposed to be allies in some way to her don't at first appear as allies. The cat shows up and the cat is scary and a menace. YB shows up with a skull mask.
Yeah.
You know, so all of these things, this world around her is menacing because it's weird and there's no sense of normalcy and she has no place in it. So she feels isolated. And then we get pulled into the world of the Beldam.
The other world.
Right, where the other mother is. Yes. And it's, I mean, first of all, I think
Other Mother is just a brilliant name.
It is. Right, it's the other mother. It's the one. It's the one you wish you had.
Yeah.
First of all, the visuals of it are fantastic. The whole setup for her finding this little door, which is, I mean, the whole movie has is really cribbing from Steven Spielberg's E.T. in a lot of ways. This idea of like everything is at the child's eye view. That's the reason why the door is the size that it is. It's a child's door. And we see things from her perspective. And so there's always like, it's from like her view up to a degree. And, you know, we get there, it always takes place, or at least in the beginning, at night. So it could be excused as a dream, which is also something inherently childlike about it. And then we arrive, we go through this tiny door, through this like wondrous tunnel. And all of a sudden, except for the fact that the people on the other side of that door have buttons for eyes, they are the version of her family and her world that she wishes she had.
They're the idealized, the fawning, it's, you know, Coraline is the center of attention. It's
right.
Everything a tween craves. I'm trying to remember what there, you talked the tunnel. I just want to, that's a good place to mention. So this movie was shot, stereoscopic, and of all of the 3D movies that I've seen, you know, of the dozens and dozens of 3D movies that I've seen, there are maybe two or three that I would really say have used depth as an active part of their storytelling, and that are undeniably enhanced, and in fact, like that you if you're watching the 2D version, you're not getting the full impact, and it's like Dread and Coraline.
Yes, it's weird. Yeah, I remember coming out of Coraline in theaters and having seen the 3D version of it. And I said, you know, if that was what people were doing with 3D all of the time, it would be a worthwhile use of that medium. But it's not.
But it's yeah.
That's not what people do. But yeah, it's layered. They're like, there's just, it feels like It's as though someone opened a window and you could reach through. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. It's not about things popping out at you so much as it is that kind of depth of field.
Yeah, well, it does a couple things with its depth. So you mentioned this, like a window, so it keeps everything or almost everything behind the proscenium arch, behind the plane of behind the plane of the screen, which gives it a very kind of like shoebox diorama feel, very appropriate for the visual style. And then it uses depth in ways to not just make things smaller in the background as per traditional mise-en-scène layout, but like actually then pushes things into the depth, which, you know, we're talking about the themes of this movie, that it is about, you know, isolation and feeling like you don't have a place in the world and feeling, you know, that you're present but separated from the people around you, that you can't connect with them. And so being able to use that depth to enhance that it's not just like, oh, well, smaller on screen, it's actually like back, it's away. It's able to communicate the separation between things a lot better. And then when you first get into the other world, it changes there's a foreshortening kind of effect, and the tunnel, as the tunnel kind of like grows into the depth, they use that effect to kind of recalibrate your brain so that you adjust to the depth being different in the other world. And so the first couple of times you're in the other world, everything's much closer. So a lot of these things do still show to a degree, like they're still very conventional quality cinematography in the 2D version, but it really was composed with depth in mind. And which is something that very, very few stereoscopic films have ever bothered to do, especially since so many of them are post-conversion anyway.
It is a sight to behold. If you have a 3D television, which is rarer and rarer these days, that is one of the few reasons that it's good that you own one of those. It doesn't happen very long.
Though Coraline, I grabbed the Blu-ray when it first came out, and it just came for me with Anaglyph 3D. So it's got a pair of glasses in there, and you know, it's green magenta separation, and it's not great, but it works. And if it's maybe not the most enjoyable way to watch it, because Anaglyph on conventional televisions is kind of weird, but if from a like education standpoint, if you want to like kind of see it to get an idea of what Dan is rambling about here, it'll work for that.
Yeah, I mean, you never know. 3D always inevitably comes back around. I think probably once we get to micro LED and 8K TVs as a standard in like 10, 20 years,
then
they'll
stick.
Be like, well, no, it'll come back for a brief period, and probably during that time, someone will re-release Coraline in that format. So it's just, my opinion is it's just a waiting game for people to, for technology to reach a certain weird point in the cycle of technology where they'll bring 3D back around. But that is neither here nor there. I think a kind of interesting depth that they play with in the subtlety of the storytelling, especially when you get to the other mother's universe the first time. So in Coraline's world, who made the dinner? Well, her dad made the dinner. And while there's no point in which they show that Coraline's world is our world, we sort of take on faith that it's probably somewhat similar. When we watch commercials in our world, the mothers are the ones that are usually making food, and the dads are always bumbling. And I assume this to be true in Coraline's world, because when she gets to the world of the Bell Dam, in fact, her mother is the one that's cooking, and her father is playing a song, but he's not really doing it because the piano plays him.
Yeah,
it plays him, and it's interesting. That's a They Might Be Giants song, that because it's piano based sounds almost kind of like a Ben Folds number, but it's really interesting that that he specifically says, because she's like my dad doesn't play the piano, and he goes, well, that's okay, kiddo, you know, this piano plays
your dad.
Yeah, it plays me, like, and that feeds into this culture that we learn from commercials. And I assume that this is what Coraline thinks things are supposed to be like.
Mm-hmm.
And not only is her mother cooking, but her mother is cooking meat. She's made a chicken breast. And I just think that choice is so specific that it can't not be completely intentional.
Yeah. I hadn't really processed that on my, I was very sick when I did my rewatch. Coraline was a great trippy experience when you're on, you know, a giant cocktail of drugs. You know, I hadn't, you're mentioning that, and now I think there's a lot of thematic stuff to explore in there, and the way that the other world, it represents, you know, what she's looking for. She's, you know, you said earlier, she's looking for stability, she's looking for normalcy, and how that ends up being initially represented is that the other world is conventional. It's patriarchal, television.
Yeah, that's what's sort of fascinating about it. And really, that first cycle of her going to the world of the Beldam, the only reason for you to think it's suspect is because of the button eyes, and I guess that she gets whatever she wants, right? But from a child's point of view, it is perfect. She gets the patriarchal view of the world that she's been spoon-fed probably her whole, whatever, 10, 11, 12 years so far. And she is also given whatever she wants. Like, what do you want to drink? Mango milkshake? There it is. There's a cake right in front of her. You know what I mean? Like, anything that she could imagine, she gets.
And so we as adults are like, oh, any place where you get whatever you want is inherently suspect.
Right. It's Faustian in some way. There's a bargain here.
Yeah.
But, you know, for a child, there's no reason to suspect. So the shorthand for this isn't safe at first is button eyes. And then when we get back to the real world, and I think that I like the visual that the first two times she goes, she falls asleep in the Beldam world and wakes up in the normal world.
Mm-hmm.
And then each time she sort of goes and explores her normal world a little bit more and finds more alienation from the people around her. Even the ones who are trying to make her feel welcome are not really doing a very good job.
Actually, we should talk about the button eyes real quick.
Sure.
So I think the brilliance of the button eyes is that they work so well for the transitioning sinisterness of the other world. In that the first time you go there, it's like, okay, well, it's unsettling. Like it is a tell that things are maybe not necessarily, you know, totally on the up and up in the other world. But the button eyes themselves are like they're charming enough, and the fact that it's stop motion and that everything already looks like a doll and that there is a literal in-universe doll that has button eyes, that it's like that the button eyes are in their own way charming.
Sure, cute as a button.
But they are different enough that as then things evolve, they are able to move from being just like, oh, well, this charming quirk of the other world, to being kind of this element of the sinisterness of the other world. So they play both roles incredibly well. And so that, you know, that goes to sort of the design choice and the and all of that. And I think it's a fantastic little element of visual storytelling there with the button eyes.
There's a really great way that they eventually, I think, completely pull the button thing away for the facade that it is. And it's before we get the reveal of the Beldam. It's a really nice touch. And that is that so the reason that Coraline finds out about this world at all is because there are these mice, or kind of mice. I think that's what they're supposed to be, right? They're like weird hoppy looking things, but they have button eyes.
They're like kangaroo mice, which, yeah. I mean, it's in the Pacific Northwest, so they're out of place, but yeah.
They are sort of the only thing that's able to break through, right? They're sort of like these, they manage to just kind of sneak under the wire for whatever reason. They're small, they're able to kind of get into the real world, and they're cute. Everything about them is adorable, and there is an interesting disparity in the two worlds regarding one specific character, that being the cat, which is that the cat can only talk in the Beldam world. And the cat really becomes an ally there, and the cat is the one that kind of leads the way, specifically wherein you get, what is it? He grabs one of the mice and bites down on it, even though he says he doesn't like rats, and it transforms. Like, not only does all of the sand come out of it, but it stops being a mouse and becomes this big, ugly rat.
Mm-hmm.
Which is terrifying. It's a really great, scary moment that sort of unmasks that not everything about this world is what it seems. She's given no reason to like the situation that she's in, Coraline. She's going to a private school, one assumes, because she goes to their mother to get...
the uniform.
And everything is this very gray, very drab color. And she just wants to buy these gloves. And the thing that's interesting is that the gloves pop in that world because they are of a color of the other mother's world, of the Beldam's world, because everything is brighter there at first.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother shoos them away and says, no. You know, you have to dress like everybody else. And she ignores or is irritated by Coraline, like trying to sort of scoot around on the stool with the wheels on it. She's trying to find some way to have fun in this very boring endeavor that she's going through. And yeah, like her parents constantly, they're focusing on their book. So that they're like, we understand that they have to be able to make money so that things are going to be okay. So they can stay where they've moved, so that they feel like they've got a certain degree of safety. But Coraline has no reason to understand that. And a child watching this also has no reason to understand why the parents are acting the way that they're acting. It's a great duality.
The great thing there, or the effective thing there is, I do think kids respond to, like, kids can intuit sort of the economic troubles of the family, even if they can't appreciate or comprehend the nuances or the timeline or the permanency of it. Like, if there's economic stress in the house,
sure,
kids pick up on that.
But all they have to go on that is that they feel, again, same thing.
Yeah.
They are scared. They feel isolated. Because they don't have the ability to grasp the nuance, just the surface, it's just scary, and that's
it. Yeah. So, like, it's not something that they have any interaction with or control of, and so they don't understand that it's like, oh, well, no, you see, dad just needs to get this in so that we get, you know, it's like, we got the advance, but now I need to get the manuscript in so that we can actually start getting paid. And it's like, and the kids, what?
Yeah. And meanwhile, you know, everything is so weird about that house. So YB is not, as a friend, he's not really a very good friend. You've got Sergei Bobinski, played, I think, perfectly by Ian McShane. And the thing about him, and they even say it in the narrative, which I had forgotten, is that they suggest that he's an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, that's a buzzword. That's a big, scary word. Like, a kid's not going to understand, again, the nuance, but it's scary. That's a thing to be avoided. And then, you know, these older ladies that were young and are now old and have a house full of taxidermied dogs and really old candy, that she can't actually eat. Again, it's very alienating. It's very scary. Why would she want to interact with these people? They're weird.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, if you add all of those things up, button eyes don't really seem that scary.
Not so scary, especially since the common thread with Babinski and the ladies whose names I'm just spacing on.
Oh, April Spink and Miriam Forcible.
Spink and Forcible. The common thread, and this goes to then the other world part of it, is that when Coraline initially goes and visits them, they're, I don't want to say like egotist, but they are kind of self-involved. Like the conversations revolve around like lost glory.
Right.
You know, they're like, whether it be Babinski's, like his, well, I guess in both cases, it's about a, I don't want to say failed, but faded career in performance.
Right. And when you go to this other world, they are what it is that they are trying to purport to be. Babinski actually does have all these mice. They put on an amazing show. And a thing that is really interesting is that when you go to see Spink and Forcible, not only do they put on a really great show themselves, but partway through, they unzip themselves and are still young underneath. Which is amazing. Absolutely gets the heart. I mean, that's a thing that I think that, again, with children, there is the surface that they grasp. But boy, if you're an adult, that there is something really dense about that.
Yeah. But then in the other world, so it's like they are their idealized selves, whether it be like the younger versions of themselves or the more talented versions of themselves. But then they use that in a way that revolves around Coraline. So rather than just sitting there and like telling her stories about, you know, it's like, oh, well, we used to be these amazing performers and all of this.
We put on the show for you.
It's a show for her.
She's at the center of the show of the two women. She actually gets pulled into it.
Yeah. And it's that centering element that is this, the commonality of the other world, and is definitely the hook that the Beldam is using. Is it's like, oh, well, you are the most, you are the focal point of this universe. And that ultimately is the thing that that Coraline needs to grow up and get over in order to move on with her life, is accepting that, you know, she is not the center of the universe. She shouldn't expect to be the center of the universe, and doing so is in fact damaging. And if you get too lost in it, then if you get too self-involved, then you quite literally lose your soul. And yeah, so it helps her then build empathy for the real world versions of Spink and Forcible and Babinski, which
and her parents,
and her parents, which then, you know, in the finale, you can see that I don't even want to say that she's helped bring them out of their shells, because this goes back to sort of the timeline thing of like, so, okay, well, tweens aren't going to appreciate timelines, that, you know, Spink and Forcible and Babinski aren't really actually absurdly self-involved. It's just was just the first impression, because it's like, Coraline, you've only met these people like once.
Yeah.
For a few minutes. Like there's more to them and their lives than just like, you know, that one meeting. Because then when she sees them at the end and they remember things about her that she, you know, that she told them, and they ask her questions. So it was just this like weirdo first impression, and not, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, once again, like just like with the Beldam being the one that cooks the meal instead of the father, it's the same concept, right? She sees adults and expects them to act the way they do on TV.
Yeah,
right. She's got almost like a Full House impression of how adults are supposed to behave. You know, like weird, but centered on you, the child. And when they're not that, it really does have an impact. And I think something that's great is that kids do pick up on nuance. We've been talking about this a lot. And one of the core differences between Coraline's real mother and the Beldam is that her mother is, for better or worse, very honest about where things are. She may not always give the full thought because she doesn't, you know, because she's an imperfect parent. Nobody comes out the gate a great parent. You know, it's hard. But the Bell Dam puts on this show of support and the show of caring, but they use a very specific visual cue, and it's her wrapping her fingers on the table because she's impatiently waiting for Coraline to put those buttons on her eyes. And everything is in service of that and nothing else. And what's great about the film is that they know, the people that put this story together, that Coraline is smart enough to pick up on that. And when they say that Coraline is smart enough to pick up on that, they're also trusting the children in the audience to be able to pick up on that, which I think is great. Like, they show them just enough. They make a point of you seeing it. But when you see the tapping of the fingers,
like the tapping of the fingers, and there's a music cue that goes with, or I guess an absence of a music cue. They build it very, they use cinematic language, and they trust that the audience is going to pick up on it because they have a lot of respect for kids, and they believe that their target audience is like, no, they'll get it.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of faith in our audience.
And that is the difference between good children's horror and the bad kind, right? Like,
yeah.
When I grew up, you know, Disney would air these things called, it was called like Mr. Boogity. And everything about it is, you know, it's gross out humor. Everything is like supreme shorthand. Everything is silly with a mix of like maybe a little bit of scare here and there. But everything is painted so broad and so bright that there's no way you could miss it. You'd have to be an imbecile. And that is all of the bad. That's the ill of something being for kids, I suppose, in general, not just in horror, but I think when you look at horror, like really, especially that sort of comes out. And Coraline is a film that is designed to trust that children will get what's happening, mm-hmm. that they will understand things. And they really don't hold back, because by the time you get to time number three, when you're understanding that the Bell Dam is the Bell Dam at all and not an other mother, but this specific malevolent force, they grant a lot to kids that they're going to be able to handle the death of other children.
Yep.
And the Bell Dam is visually terrifying, a really scary visage, and also that they're going to be able to listen to Keith David as the cat say that the Bell Dam is trying to be loving in her weird way. It's so strange, but that she represents the worst in Coraline in a way. She's like a dark mirror for what Coraline could become if she just keeps thinking about herself as the heart of the universe.
Yeah, this consumptive, self-involved sort of love. That it's like she loves her parents, but that manifests as a demand that they subsume themselves into her needs. Yeah. And, you know, and which is understandable in a tween, but is deadly in a parent.
Right, and or in any adult person, but yes, especially a parent. And yeah, the way that they sort of manifest it is that not only does she want the buttons over the eyes, but we see firsthand from the ghosts of these three kids what happens as a result of that she does. She feasts on them, you know, she devours them. That is a term that the cat uses, right? So he says, well, she just wants to love you or eat you. Which is her version of love. She would love to eat you.
They're the same to her. I mean, and if you want to go into sort of that realm of like, it's like, okay, well, things that adults are going to pick up on that kids aren't, and you know, maybe the kind of thing that parents are going to be like, this is too dark for kids. It's going to be that element of like saying that it's like, oh well, you know, this is a parental figure in the same way that Coraline wants. You know, it's like, oh well, parents who just kind of like behave, a parent who wants children who just behave and do exactly what is told, that is analogous to eating them, to enslaving their souls. You know, that's the moment where like adults go, it's like, this is too dark for kids. And it's like, no, kids aren't going to get that part of it. Like, you know, they're going to get that something that there's something sinister is going, but they're not going to appreciate that element of the metaphor until they're like much older.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of a kids geared horror movie or a children's movie that with horror elements that works, that has that blending of scare and wonder, is that when you come back to it as an adult, you get a whole other series of layers.
I mean, and that's Gaiman's skill as a writer. I mean, Selleck did, I think, an absolutely stellar job at adapting that into screenplay format, and keeping though from what I understand, Gaiman was quite involved with the adaptation process, and it really shows that it was not a adversarial relationship at all, like that it was collaborative, and he was a welcome collaborator on it, because it has his fingerprints all over it for the better.
Yeah. And then in the end, it does what a kid's horror movie should do, which is that it makes you feel safe when it's all over. Because that's what, I mean, I think everybody to a degree, but especially kids, they want to be scared. And then when it's all over, they want to feel okay. And it's not just that it does that, but it's the way that it does it. It resolves this understanding in Coraline that the Beldam and the world that she has created and inhabits is unhealthy.
Yeah.
And in its heart, abusive. And it removes the wonder from that and supplants the wonder back where it belongs, which is in her everyday world.
Yeah. That, hey, your weirdo neighbors are actually like really interesting people.
Yeah. And your parents, once they're able to get past their moment where they're struggling, they do care and they are interesting. And one of the great buttons, is that Coraline's mother does in fact buy her the gloves, the mittens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just interesting. And they build, instead of this garden that looks like Coraline in the Beldam world, we end up with a garden that everybody is working on together with Coraline, which was Coraline's idea, which is in and of itself wondrous and beautiful and powerful and potent, I think.
Well, and one of the recurring things that we've mentioned is that sort of timeline thing of that it helps kind of instruct that shift in perspective that's necessary for that age group of life. It's like, okay, well, yeah, like things, you know, people have their own thing going on, but like that's not necessarily forever. That it's like she was so feeling so isolated, but it's like, no, the garden still happened. People just, it just needed, they people had some other stuff that they needed to get done first, and then everybody was able to work on the garden. And yeah, so I think it's a good moment. Can I just complete change of topic, sort of? Terry Hatcher,
oh yeah,
does an absolutely stellar job at playing Coraline's mother and other mother as two super distinct characters. To the point that, like, in my memory, I kind of sit there and go, like, I know Terry Hatcher's the Beldam, but does she also do Coraline's mom, or is that just another voice actress who sounds a lot like, but it's like, no, it is Terry Hatcher in both roles, and she really, like, the characters are distinct enough that they feel like completely different characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody really turns in a great performance, but gosh, I think if you had to say who steals the show, it's definitely Terry Hatcher, because it speaks to the elasticity of her as a performer.
Mm-hmm.
That she's able to do two things that are inexorably tied to each other, yet are so opposing, and make them feel exactly as the same and is exactly as disparate and different as they need to be. Anyway, I always try to end every episode of this podcast with other recommendations. So you liked this thing. What else should you watch? But in this case, I think we can also sort of say, so your kid watched Coraline. What other horror movies are suitable for children?
I think a lot of the things that I threw out back at the beginning, a lot of the other ones that I mentioned, and maybe that, I guess part of it would be like, okay, well, we kind of do need to dig into history here, because they're just, the root thesis here is they just don't make that many of these kinds of movies anymore. I'm actually trying to think, like, how many other children's horror movies have even really come out in the last decade. Paranorman, which I already admitted I haven't seen.
Yeah. I mean, I can speak to that. Those are both worthwhile.
So there really kind of is otherwise this, like, gulf, this desert for children's horror movies that aren't just like, oh, well, kind of, you know, monster themed comedy. So you do need to go earlier. Here's going to be my weird recommendation. I'm going to say Ernest Scared Stupid.
You're really going to go there, Vern?
It's not a good movie. It's not. It's not. But I think if your kids liked Coraline, they'll probably enjoy Ernest Scared Stupid, and then 5 years from now, they'll realize that it is, like, an atrocious film. That it is an atrocious film that has just something about it that is charming. That it has this je ne sais quoi. There is a charm and spirit to that movie, despite it being not good.
I would say of the films that you discussed probably my number one pick at the top, if I was going to say, put my hand on my heart, you watch Coraline. It's weird. I mean, like, it doesn't really involve children, but it does involve mice. Secret of Nim is my honest to God go-to. It was probably one of the first animated films I really remember seeing as a kid. That I think is, again, it has, like, that right balance, you know? Because, like, I also saw Pinocchio as a kid, and I got to tell you, I don't know. I don't know if I would be showing that to any kid of mine. That movie is just terrifying. That movie is really, I mean, I guess if they really begged me, but I wouldn't be offering that one up. I'd be like, Secret of Nim, for sure. If I was gonna show my kid something that's scary, that shouldn't have had a PG rating, is the reason that there are PG-13 ratings, you know what? I saw Poltergeist as a kid. That's a scary movie for kids. I consider that to be a horror movie for the whole family.
All right.
I really stand by that. I mean, maybe the kid should be, like, you know, 12 at that point, but I was really young when I saw Poltergeist, and I loved it then, and I still consider it to be in my top five favorite horror movies, period, now.
See, and when you originally asked the question, I thought you were going to ask, like, what was the first, like, horror movie you saw that you really shouldn't have seen? And I was going to say Darkman.
Oh, gosh, really?
Yeah.
Sam Raimi joint?
Like, this was the thing, is I wasn't allowed to watch it. I watched it from the hallway. I was supposed to be in bed, but so I was, like, in the hallway kind of looking around the corner past the couch, and I watched, like, 75% of Darkman like that. Oof. as my parents were watching it.
I wonder how many kids Sam Raimi was a part of their of their horror discovery, because certainly I was very young. I remember renting Evil Dead 2 because it's the least sexy one. I don't know. I was allowed to see it. I watched it with my dad and I loved it, and that was another thing that cemented my interest in the genre. But yeah, I would be curious to see. And we did an episode of Everyday Horror that you can listen to that is all about Drag Me to Hell. And we talk about Sam Raimi extensively because that is one of his. Anyway, thanks, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me out for this. I got to talk about one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, it's a great one. Before we wrap, can you tell people where they can find you online?
So on YouTube, if you look up Folding Ideas, or the best way to find me is I will be smack talking Nestle on Twitter at Foldable Human. You can watch me pick fights with all sorts of hashtag brand accounts.
Good work. And my name is Danny Roth, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N. Ordinary, also with one N. Thank you for listening, and remember, sometimes the best cure for the horrors of every day is a little everyday horror. Thanks for listening.